so much of our lives inside. Either in traffic, at work, or close eyes. How about we all agree that it's way overdue to take back our lives?
What's up, everybody? Welcome into the Work Wherever podcast, the podcast where we talk about AI, automation, the ability to work wherever so you can live every day like it is Saturday. It's not Saturday. It's actually Friday. It's Good Friday that we're recording this, and I'm in my PJs. I figured that I had been getting dressed and putting on clothing and for the recordings of these podcasts, and then going immediately changing into what you see here. So I figured, you know what? I would just roll it out. It is the Work Wherever podcast. It's not the business casual podcast. It's not the office cubicle podcast. So I figured I would be true to the podcast and keep it a little simple. And if you are listening for the first time, thank you for coming on. We do have four flavors of the podcast. We have Roy's Rants, that's me by myself. We have Internet Hotspot, that's me and Sydney talking about news and the trends around technology, AI, and automation, as well as working wherever. We have Homegrown with Haley, that's my wife. She's usually sitting in this chair right here. And we're talking about a lifestyle podcast. We're talking about homeschooling. We're talking about homesteading. We're talking about all of the things that we get to enjoy because we work wherever. And then that leads us to the fourth one, which is our guest podcasts. And that is one that we have today. So we have Josh Kosnick on today. He is an EOS implementer. He is the host of the Spartan Leadership Podcast. He's a good buddy of mine. Smart smoker of cigars, drinker of bourbon, all around good human being and Christian man. Welcome to the Work Wherever Podcast, my guy, Josh Kosnick. What's up, buddy?
Hey. Thanks for having me, brother. Excited to spend some time with you and your audience this morning. And yes, I do have a cigar. No bourbon, though, this morning. I'm on 75 yeah. hard. I got work to do today, so I'll enjoy the Cuban cigar with my coffee.
Not a bad way to start the day. Yeah. Do you start the day every day with a nice cigar? Is that like part of your morning routine?
Yeah, we're going to hope my wife doesn't listen to your podcast. And so, yes, I do. It's almost at least every weekday when I'm out here at the farm. Not typically at home on the weekend when I'm with the kids or chasing them around or running them to basketball or dance or whatever. But yeah, if I'm here at the farm, I'm starting my day with a Cuban cigar and coffee.
There's worse ways to start your day, I'll tell you.
<That's>... For sure.
So your farm... Tell me about the farm. I mean, that's a perfect place to start, I feel like, because you bought it in a way to support your mission of leadership in men, right? I believe that's the...
Yeah.
I'm sure there were other reasons why you bought the farm and picked the one that you wanted, but I believe you bought it for this grand vision. So let's start with the farm, if you don't mind.
Yeah, not a problem. It actually came through a lot of pain, right? So... My exit of my last company, my financial firm, was not an smooth, easy, or pleasant experience. It was a 6-month negotiation after being terminated. We can get into that story if you want, but the bottom line is it took 6 months to negotiate this exit, and I'm being recruited throughout the financial industry, and something in my gut wasn't feeling right. Like, and I had to keep leaning into it, keep praying to God, and understand what it was. Because I had a $2 million offer sitting on the table from another financial firm to have me go and rebuild what I had already built. And it's a lot of money. And also, not beyond the money, it's everything I had already known and done for 17 plus years. So I had to figure out, like, what was this gut feeling? What was God trying to tell me? And it really came down to is that I had accomplished everything that I needed to in that industry, and it was time to create a new vision. And the other thing was that I could lean into was I never wanted to put my family or myself in the position to have what happened happen again, to be terminated, to have everything just ripped away. So I wanted to build something of my own. And as I started thinking about leadership coaching, helping people solve problems, helping people build systems and processes to help them scale and grow, stuff that I had been trained at, good at, built over the past 17 plus years, I'm like, man, I started sharing this with my wife and she's like, yeah, but I don't want you traveling all the time. And I was like, that's fair. Cause we have four young kids. And so I had this field of dreams moment. If you build it, they'll come. And in that event, what happened was I started thinking about 80 to 100 acres of blank land that I could build whatever I wanted to build on it. And so I started envisioning, okay, what if I could take people out of their work world, their fluorescent lights, computer screens, kind of like your work wherever, right? Is to be able to give them an environment where they can lean back into nature, where they can lean and work inward in themselves, in their spiritual being, in their mental being, their physical being, and go back to their workplace, go back to their home life as better human beings. And so as I came about this, I shared this vision with one other person. It's just amazing how God works. I had already seen like, I don't know, 6 to 8 other properties, some with older buildings on it, some just blank land, and you can build it all and whatever. And then I had a buddy I shared this vision with, and he's like, have you seen this place yet? And shows me this amazing video. And I'm like, no, it's not even listed on MLS. And so I send the video to my realtor. I said, hey, go get us a showing. And again, how God works. I show up here and they ask me to sign an NDA. And I'm like, I'm viewing a property. What am I signing an NDA for? They're like, oh, the owner's just really private. And I said, okay, well, if I'm signing this, who's the owner? And it was the guy that built my wife and I's first house. And so it was just amazing how things come full circle. And he's a Christian man as well. And I'm sharing with him my story, like, hey, I have this lump sum of money coming with the sale of my firm. I don't know when. I'm in the middle of this negotiation. It's been a lot of back and forth. It's gotten kind of ugly. And we just kept talking. And he actually graciously did a land contract with me short term, because I want to get to traditional financing as soon as possible and get him off the hook. But like, he did not have to do that. It was just two Christian men that happened to know each other a little bit, chatting it up, and him believing in my vision and graciously extending that olive branch.
I love the vision. I love the idea. And we have a similar vision and mission within our organization. It is, I call it dinner table time, where we have this, you know, I might be older than you, Josh, I don't know, but we grew up in a similar time. And when we were growing up, it was this idea that dad was gone and you spent time without him. And if you got 45 minutes of dad time a day, then that was a good thing, right? And he was late to your baseball game and he didn't come to practice. And you know, if he did, it was a treat. And you know, we grew up with movies, and I've referenced this before on the podcast, but we grew up with that movie Hook. That's one of my favorite movies. Yeah. And the opening scene is Peter Pan, Rufio. Right? Where he is. Yeah. Amen, man. Rufio. I love it. I just got goosebumps. The opening scene is Peter Pan as an adult, and he's become the stereotypical dad where he can't make the game, right? He has to send the video camera. And he doesn't make it to his kid's baseball game. And that's like what drives his kids into Captain Hook, right? And that, to me, that whole opening scene is everything that I believe is wrong with the American family right now. It's the removal of the dad or any of the parents, really, in any capacity, where we're dividing the family. Not in a sense of like, it's not a core nucleus of the family, but you're displacing the family, whether you're putting in school or you're taking the dad out for long periods of time or you're sending the mom somewhere. And that dinner table time to me is so sacred. And I love the mission of getting people out into the world, getting people together, getting people out of the office, getting people into nature or anywhere that's not a concrete jungle of what has been dubbed as normal for, you know, corporate America.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. This has been on my heart. It's been on my heart, actually, quite recently. It's perhaps the biggest lie we've been fed.
Yeah.
For us to split up. Like, think about mom. Think about how many moms and dads both work nowadays because they have to, mm-hmm. to fund their lifestyle or whatever it may be. Or even if it's because they want to, but it's perhaps the biggest lie we've been told that we at 8 a.m. or 7 a.m. have to split up the family. All of us go our separate ways and then to come back together and have only a couple hours together.
Right. It's sad, man. That's normal to not eat breakfast with your children. That's normal.
Yeah.
It's a scary thing, man. And I applaud you for the mission you're on. And I love the farm story, and I can't wait to see it. I think I get to see it this August. I wasn't there last time you had people out. But I'm looking forward to it, man. And it's a beautiful property. How many acres do you have?
80.
Yeah, that's a little bit. How do you mow this?
A little bit. So, oh man, dude, I had to hire a college kid because it was taking up like 6 hours of my day because I was mowing the trails as well as the, you know, 15 acres of actual manicured grass. But then we have woodlands that the trails go through. You and I are both beekeepers, you know, so I have that stuff back there as well. And then we have some hay fields. So we have about 20 acres of actual quote unquote ag land that has to be ag. So we just do hay to feed the alpacas and horses and goats and whatever else we choose to get in the future. And then we got about 35 to 40 acres of woodlands. And then everything else is, we got a little bit of wetlands and a stream that flows through the middle. It's awesome.
So great. This is quickly turning into a Homegrown with Haley podcast. She's going to come in here and start asking questions about goats and alpacas. I feel like I have that question like every day from her. She's like, you know, what if we were to get goats? What if we were to get this? And we have chickens now. So we have bees and chickens. And it's an ever-growing thing, man. Oh, it's another life out here, man. And I can't imagine having 80. I have 5. And five seems overwhelming to me some days. 80 is just, I mean, that's the goal, right? It's a beautiful thing you have out there. And I'm sure, you know, the systems and processes that got you to where you were at, that you implemented at your previous employer. Are we allowed to say your previous employer? I know that there were...
I don't care. I choose not to talk about them much.
Yeah, let's
just, no, neither good nor bad. It just...
Yeah.
Leave-bottable.
Yeah, no real use. It was a large financial institution that you built a huge practice at, and you got really, really good at systems and processes. In fact, when I needed an intern program and I had questions around onboarding of members, I turned to Josh and I said, hey, Josh, man, tell me about your intern program. Tell me about the things that you're doing over there and about your systems and processes, because I didn't have any experience in doing anything with intern, and I knew that you had a ton of experience with it. So I know you're an EOS guy. So before we dive in and nerd out on EOS, what is EOS for those maybe who haven't heard the acronym before?
Yeah, so real high level, it stands for Entrepreneurial Operating System. And the EOS creed is every business should run on an operating system, and it only should be one. And right, so we believe it should be EOS, those of us that have chosen that path. But there are other operating systems out there. And as Roy's kind of saying, is like every business should have an operating system that they run on and really choose their systems and processes wisely, because it'll help you be more efficient, help you scale and grow. So Entrepreneur Operating System was started by Gino Wickman. It's now actually a franchise model. I can't remember the company offhand. I always forget it, that he sold it to. But the reason he sold it was to be able to scale, really. He couldn't do that on his own. He needed a larger company, a PE firm, essentially, if you will, that could help them scale and grow to have the impact that they want. Because we have somewhere between 30 and 40,000 businesses operating on EOS right now worldwide. The goal is by 2030 to be at 100,000. So we have these goals out there as well, because we know that as businesses utilize this system, the more likely they are to succeed, the more likely they are to be profitable, to frankly just have more fun.
Yeah, there's a few different aspects of EOS that I really, really like. And one is, I like the expansion of the idea that operating systems are a major part of business, especially with entrepreneurs, because many entrepreneurs have this wing it mentality, which is fine. At first, you need a little bit of wing it in you, right? You started the business because you had a little bit of wing it in you. But at some point, in order to get it so it's really churning, you got to put some standardization in it. And generally, that happens when you can't do it yourself anymore, right? You're moving from a solopreneur to hiring your first employee. And I would love to get your take on how to make the first hire. What I've generally found is that people take one of two paths, right? You hire the really experienced person, thinking that they're going to come in and you're going to clone your... That's the best way to clone myself is hiring the most experienced and highest paid person, right? That's track number one. Track number two is you hire somebody with little to no experience who's just a go-getter and you let them run and then maybe at one point you get a little angry because they're not doing exactly like you did or like you do, right? So how do you make that first hire and how do you create systems so that you don't run down one of those two paths?
That's a great question. I think the cloning yourself methodology is absolutely wrong to begin with. Because you're not actually trying to clone yourself. What you're trying to do is make two of you that allows you to get into the task that you're great at and that you love doing and get out of the task that you're not great at and don't like doing. So when you think about that and break that down, like draw a line down the middle, essentially what you're saying is you don't want a clone of you. You actually want the opposite of you.
Right.
You want someone that's skilled in these areas that you're not great at. And so I think utilizing strengths finders, I think Kolbe, K-O-L-B-E, is a great tool to utilize in that aspect as well to figure out where you're strong and where you're weak and hiring someone to where you're weak. But really even further than that, if you want to get more granular, is what are the tasks that you're not great at but are necessary to be done? And look for someone and build a job description around that. So for instance, in sales, when I started as a financial advisor, I was terrible at paperwork and detail and follow through. But follow through and paperwork and detail are all necessary aspects of the job. You have to have to, because compliance wise with dealing with people's money, we got to make sure we have the details right. We got to make sure we have the paperwork right. We got to make sure we have the notes right. But that's not my general skill set. My skill set is talking to people, leadership, being able to sell well, to be able to recruit well. So basically being the face and the mouth, but all the detail stuff I needed help with. If I was left to do with that, like it was going to be a mess and compliance would have fired me right away. So it's figuring out what needs to be done, but is not naturally in your skill set. Dan Sullivan, who owns and runs Strategic Coach up in Canada, probably one of the largest mastermind organizations in the world, he talks about unique abilities. And your unique abilities are what are you great at doing and love doing. Like you absolutely love it, and God uniquely gifted you with that skill set. And that's where you want to spend the bulk of your time. The rest of the things, and actually the trap is stuff that you kind of like doing and you're good at doing. That's the trap. The stuff that you don't like doing and you're not good at, that's easy to delegate. But the trap is stuff that you like doing and you're kind of good at. What you really want to focus on, kind of that Pareto principle, the 80-20 principle, is what are you great at doing and love doing? And then be able to hire towards the rest of it.
So then what you're saying is instead of working a position to hire for that position, hire for what you're not good at so that you can do more of what you love or what you're passionate or called to do. Am I hearing that correctly?
Yes, because typically as an entrepreneur, it's a unique position because what you love doing or what you're great at doing is typically the revenue generating thing. So whether you are in sales like me or technology like you, it's the revenue driver. So yeah. That's why I say that as an entrepreneurial world, it's pretty... It may not be 100% of the time that way, but usually if the entrepreneur is the one and you start as a solopreneur and you're driving revenue, that tends to be the thing that you are uniquely gifted at. So, okay, let's go drive more revenue and figure out and hire people that can do the other stuff that isn't A, what you're great at, and B, isn't as much of a revenue driver.
Yeah. At what point do you become, or do you think that you should take yourself out of those positions, or should you always be involved in the business?
So
I know there's not a clear cut answer there, right? I mean, I feel like it's kind of a situational, but I'd love your take.
Yeah, the dreamscape, I think, is getting to the owner's box, right? It's I use the Patriots when they had Belichick and Brady and Robert Kraft. the one thing that Robert Kraft did really well is he turned over the keys to Belichick and didn't get involved.
Yeah.
Okay. So love or hate the Patriots, I'm a diehard Bears fan, and it's freaking miserable because our ownership does not keep their meddling hands and minds out of the operations of the business, and therefore we always make stupid decisions. So what I appreciate about the example of the Patriots is Robert Kraft hired a brilliant coach that he allowed to run the team and run and get the best coaches and the best players possible so that they go win a bunch of Super Bowls. That's the goal, right? So same thing with your businesses. You got to determine, first of all, a lot of business owners struggle letting go of the vine. And what happens is that vine gets wrapped around your hand so tight it actually cuts off the circulation. So a lot of times it's best to let go of the vine, but you got to be able to trust the people and empower your people to hand that vine off to. And so I think it's a utopian type world for a business owner to get there to that owner's box. But what you got to get really good at then is human development, leadership development, which is what I love. I could talk about that all day. And then also empowerment and delegating and elevating. And delegate and elevate is kind of those buzzwords that a lot of influencers toss out there. EOS actually has a tool to be able to help people do that. But that empowerment and people development so that you're essentially working yourself out of a job through human development. That's how you get to the owner's box. That's how you build trust and empowerment in your team. So when we draw out the EOS chart where there's visionary at the top, integrator right underneath them, and then the frontline leaders of marketing, sales, finance, operations, what they don't show in traction is actually there's a box up here called the owner's box, because most businesses rarely get there. Where the owner box can, they can be the GM, or not the GM, just the true owner like Robert Kraft, and allow the players that they developed over time and really, really trust to run the day-to-day of the business. And they essentially become, their own board of directors or the CEO of the board, but the company's being ran by their amazing leadership team.
So from solopreneur to owner's box, there's personal development, you said leadership development, empowering, and delegating.
Yeah.
Which I would love to tell you that I'm a great delegator, and I feel like I'm getting better. But that is one of the hardest things to do. And I'm a big systems guy. I started out my career writing SOPs for the federal government, wrote hundreds of them, under the Obama administration that scaled off generic drugs. And that's my background, right? Systems and processes, government red tape. That's me, right? That's where I come from. So I get the systems and processes. I get the SOPs. I get the importance of churn and delegation. But that doesn't mean it's easy. I mean, that is one of the harder things, especially when it's your business. So how do you cross it? It is. So how do you do that? How do you build that trust to be able to delegate? Hey, you're in that role and I just need to, from day one, this is your responsibility? Is there a hand-holding? What's the grace that I allow both myself and the individual? How do I delegate? I mean, I feel like that's every new entrepreneur, anyone who's implementing a system is like, delegation is always the roadblock, I feel like.
Yeah. You're right. It's hard. You're right on both accounts. It's hard, and it is a roadblock for most entrepreneurs. And so let me give you an analogy, because I know you love your kids dearly. When you were teaching, your firstborn was a boy, right?
Yes, sir. Yep.
Yeah. So you're teaching your son how to ride a bike for the first time. And you know there's a chance when you let go of the back of that seat in him that he could crash and mess up his knee or hit his head or whatever. And you love your son, but you know there's a chance he could essentially fuck this up and hurt himself. Mm-hmm. But you're going to let go anyhow, right?
Yeah.
Because why?
Because he needs to learn how to ride a bike. Yeah.
So that's the analogy I'd like to give you guys there, is because he needs to learn how to ride a bike. So our mutual friend, Aaron Opelousky has this great quote, and I'll never forget it. You got to let your people dent the car without totaling the car. And I think in this scenario, when you're talking about delegating and elevating, it's a, yes, there's a trust factor there, but also it's what's best for the business. Because what's best for the business is getting the right people in the right seat working in their unique abilities. So what they're great at doing and love doing. And specifically, that starts at the top. That starts with you. So you got to get, when we started as a solopreneur, we handled everything. And then we hire that first person. And now we go to war together and we're both in battle, you know, in the trenches, and we're both doing things that neither of us really like, but we got to get them done. And then we continue to hire and we shed off some of those responsibilities. Well, the goal over time is to continue to do that. So you're just in that upper left quadrant that you're working in your God-given gifts and you absolutely love doing what you're doing. Because if you're there, then everyone, and you work towards everyone else getting there, you're building an army, an absolute force to be reckoned with, because everyone, and you think about culture and retention. If they're working in their unique abilities and what they're great at doing and love doing, and let's assume that you're paying them even close to market rate, they're not going anywhere.
Yeah. The roadblock, the self roadblock, I feel like is one of the more harder realizations that entrepreneurs go through as they build up. There's that grasp of like, I want to be involved. I want to be the decision maker because I'm paid to make decisions, or it's my business, my decisions, which are all true things. But at some point, that decision of yourself is the roadblock where you could have 20, 30, 50. Absolutely. Yeah. So how do you overcome
it? It's ego.
It's just to overcome an ego.
So it is. It's we're leaning into humility. There's a great book called Humilitas. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right, but I think it's basically the Greek word for humility. And great book. Actually, funny enough, I told you guys I'm a Bears fan. I was at this Mike McCarthy fundraiser for the Children's Hospital when he was the head coach of the Packers, and he introduced me to that book, had the team with Aaron Rodgers, and I think it was right after they won the Super Bowl. That was the book that he chose to keep them humble to try and continue being a path towards another Super Bowl. But I picked up that book after that, and it's a great book on humility, you know, Emotional Intelligence 2.0. I also love the book Positive Intelligence, which is a different spin on emotional intelligence, a more neuroscience-based. So continue to lean into that as a leader. Continue to lean into your own humility and understand, because actually, before you even said that, I had on my mind that most of the time the leader, their problem letting it go is they think they can do it better than anyone else.
Yeah, right.
And sometimes that might be true, but our ego is going to tell us that all the time that's true. And here's what I will tell you is like, even if someone can do it, say 60, you set the percentage, but let's say they can do it 60 to 75% as good as you, and you get that off your plate and you can work on something that's higher value, it's totally worth doing. I'll say you set the percentage, whatever you're comfortable with. I don't think it needs to be higher than 80, though. But if you say 60% they can do it as good as me, or I can train them to do it as good as me, it's a 60% level, let it go.
Yeah. The training aspect, I had a really hard time with that in the beginning, and I feel like I've gotten a lot better at it. Where I was training members, people up, getting them to a point, and I feel like I'm really good at training. I feel like that's one of my God-given gifts is the ability to train. And so I would train people up. And then oftentimes what would happen is they wouldn't necessarily get better than I was when I was doing that 100%. Sometimes that's true. But because I can't give that area of the business 100%, they are better than me even at the 80%. Because 100% of me is somewhere else, or 80% of me is somewhere else. And so me trying to do something 20% of the time, obviously things are going to fall through the cracks. I can't keep up with the industry trends. There's new releases, new things that come out. And so by them being 80% of maybe what I could do, they become 100% better than me because I can't put my whole self in it and I'm doing other things. And I feel like that's how things grow up. And that was a really, I learned that lesson the hard way, the beginning of business, trying to get hyper involved into what other people are doing, micromanaging. It's a difficult lesson, man. But when you can get other people around you that you know, like, and trust, which trust is a big thing. And I want to get into your hiring, because you have a very unique way of hiring people. But when you can get those people around you that you know, like, and trust, it becomes, you are less of the roadblock and you're able to offload and let them run. Be good at what they're good at. Yeah.
Also, ego. We feel like we need to be involved in things or need to make decisions in things or need to micromanage. That's also ego. Because if you get to the point where you're like Roy and you're such a good trainer of people, you're like, well, what use am I going to be in my own company if I train these people so well that I don't need, like, you start having these weird thoughts go through your head where someone like me needs to come over to you and slap you upside the head and go,
yeah,
hey, buddy, that's what we wanted. We're now in the owner's box. We did so well that we trained these amazing people that can now make decisions for themselves and not bring every freaking problem to your doorstep. That's what we wanted. And so you got to think through that. Like, here's a great example. I don't know if you know this about Tony Robbins, but he takes on only four individual coaching clients per year.
Hmm.
They pay him $1 million and they meet one day.
The whole year.
Of the year. The whole year.
Not a bad gig.
And so you think about this, and every single one of those people will rave about that time with Tony because they're bringing their highest value problems to him, their highest value visions, their highest value, whatever it may be, for that, because they know they're paying $1 million. So they got to get a ROI on that. They're not just going to hang out with them and just spend $1 million. I guess unless you got FU money, then you can go do that if you really valued hanging out with Tony. But I bet he's probably going to kick you out because he wanted to solve some problems for you. But you're paying $1 million for that. So that's essentially what you could think about is, I want to get myself to a point as a leader of my company that, you know, they're bringing their highest value stuff to me because I know they're so dang good at making decisions that only the most important things even cross my desk. Not what color do we need that wall to be? What artwork installation do we want over down that office? How many offices do we need? Do we want to have open office architecture? Do we want to have closed door space? How many chairs do we want at this table? Like, these are stupid decisions that an operations person should be handling, but some business owners want every freaking decision on their plate. There's a reason Steve Jobs wore a plain black turtleneck every day. There's a reason Zuckerberg wears a plain white t-shirt every day. It's decision fatigue. And too many of us business owners get into it where, I'll give you a personal example. We're doing the remodel here at the lower level last year where we got the beautiful bar and humidor and stuff of that nature. There's like this 4-inch piece of transition between the bathroom and the main room. And the people were asking me about it. It was like, I do not want to make that. Like, it can't. It was just one of those, I do not want to make that decision. Alicia, I trust you. I'm out of here. I got to go take a meeting. Like, it's just, I'm at the flooring place and I'm like, yeah, we had other major decisions to make, like on the bathroom tiling and whatnot. And they're talking about this like 4-inch transition between the doorway and the bathroom. I'm like, yeah, I don't want that. Like, no. Like, I got visibly frustrated on the outside, and I think I just left.
That's real, though, man. That I'm glad you brought up the turtleneck and the t-shirt. I was reading a book. I forget the name of the book. I think it was Think Like a Monk by Jay Shetty, I think is the book, where he talks about how monks, they wear the same thing every day, not because they don't have other clothes, although they're supposed to give up their earthly possessions. They do it so they don't cloud their minds with any decisions other than going to God and being in prayer. And as soon as that happened, I'm like, oh my goodness, I'd strip my wardrobe. I mean, you'd be hard pressed other than the stuff that my wife has gotten me to. My wife dresses me when we go to the Derby every year. And people are commenting, like, oh, you look so good. You're so... And my wife dressed me, guys. I am jeans and hoodie, if that's it. And everything in my closet is a t-shirt, a jeans, and a hoodie. And I just walk in there. I grab the same hoodie in like 12 different colors. And then I put on the same pair of jeans. And that's what my day is. And
it's a simple man, folks.
That's what it is. Yeah, you'd be hard-pressed to find me in shoes. So... But it's the... that decision fatigue, man. It was one of these things when you hear it for the first time, it just kind of hit punches you in the face where you're like, yes, I need to be making the big decisions as the manager, as the business owner, as the entrepreneur, as the whatever the next level is, and empower your people below you to make those decisions, knowing that if they choose the wrong color blue or they hang the wrong artwork, it's going to dent the car, to use your analogy, and not total it. I love that. So, empowering your people. We know we need to do that. We know we need to put people in place that we know, like, and trust. So how do we find those people? And I know that you, when I was talking about interview questions, I turned to you and I was like, what kind of questions do you ask? And you had one of the more unique interview processes. Most people want to say, you know, send me your resume, you know, what do you do about that? You know, where did you go to school? You know, what's your background? You have a different set of questions and a different process, more so than just looking at resumes. And I'd love to kind of chat, nerd out about that with you, because we do a lot of the same things because of you. So what does your hiring process look like, and how do you find these people that you know, like, and trust? I assume you go out back and you pluck them off of the Josh tree, and then there they
are. Yeah, first of all, I think that you got to determine who in your organization is a good read of people. I'll say that off the get-go, because it may not be you. Like, you may have made enough mistakes where you're like, hey, I actually am not a great judge initially of people. Over time, good. Right now or right away, maybe not so good. So when we were talking about how I interviewed, is I was on a panel once at the UW-Madison, and I'm sitting there in front of, you know, a couple hundred students, and they're asking us, what do we look for? And this Epic Systems, which you probably know in the IT world, they run over half the country's electronic medical records, and they're based here out of Madison, Wisconsin. Actually, the two wealthiest women in the world reside in Wisconsin, one being Judith Faulkner, who owns Epic Systems. And one of their head HR people is on one end and I'm on the other, and they're talking about their intricate way of looking at resumes, and did they go to Harvard, did they go to get a 4.0, even if they went to Madison or wherever else it may be, and what clubs were they in, and what's, you know, all this different stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I don't do any of that. Got answered next. I'm like, I don't even look at your resume besides to know your name. And you see a few jaws drop, especially the Epic person that just had answered. Just couldn't believe what I just said. But I was like, here's my thing, is like, I already know you coming into the interview are going to give me your SportsCenter top 10. Mm-hmm. Just like on a first date, Roy and I, when we're pitching our wives, we're going to give our SportsCenter top 10, and you're not going to get our SportsCenter bottom 10 until a few months from now, or a few dates from now. And it depends on how good you are at reading us and asking us questions, all the while we're trying to pursue you. So similar in an interview situation, you got to understand the dynamics going into an interview in the first place. They're trying to impress you. You're trying to read them. Okay? So actually, and you know, us guys in this scenario, we flip the script. Now we're the girl trying to assess if this guy or girl that's trying to impress us is real or not. So it's quite an interesting dichotomy. I think it's important that you understand that before you even go into it. So my process was actually, if I was looking for someone as a financial advisor, we would have our recruiter interview them, talk it through the culture, talk through day in the life from a 30,000 foot view, talk through, you know, what has been most impressive in their world, as far as not like what accomplishments do they necessarily have, but what impressions have been left upon them, what resiliency has been built upon in them. And if my head recruiter, who a lot of times I found this mistake in my cohorts, is they would hire a good looking young female to be a recruiter. I hired at the time he was just, he was upper 30s. By the time we left together, you know, he was in his 40s, just like me. But he was skilled. He was in banking. He was in sales. He was a good read of people. And I paid him twice as much as most people were paying their young, attractive female recruiters. Well, mine stayed with me. for 8 years before I sold the firm and he moved out as well, whereas they were replacing their recruiter every year because that young, attractive recruiter would go get another job somewhere else that paid her more. So you also got to think about that and what you're don't go to the norm. Find people that are really skilled, pay them appropriately, and build a culture together, because that recruiter is your first line as to what the culture is actually like here in your business. So if you want to get the person to the second meeting, which might be you, it might be someone else, but in my case, I wanted them to meet with 3 to 5 people in the culture, in the firm, to make sure that they were fit and we were getting different sets of eyes on that person. And so I was the last person they met with. And I, in that meeting, I got all the notes from their previous meetings. So I knew them very well before they entered the meeting. But then I'm going to ask questions like, hey, Roy, tell me about your mom. What were the top 3 lessons you learned from her? Tell me about your dad. What were the top 3 lessons you learned from him? Which one did you identify with more? Hey, Roy, what's the hardest thing you've had to overcome in your life? You know, that question right there, sometimes I would get the answer of like, oh, man, getting through college, that was the toughest, man. You know, managing the schedule, being on my own, having to do my own laundry, stuff of that nature, like, which they wouldn't even go into that detail. But I'd be like, okay, you haven't overcome shit. This is probably going to be a very difficult career for you. Versus someone that's like, you know, I lost my dad when I was 8 years old, and I became the man of the house when I was 8 years old. And I started working when I was 11, having a paper route 363 days a year. Okay, now I got some meat on the table. Now I know that person's got resiliency, and I might be offering him a position that's all commission. And I know that if they're a personality fit, I know that they're going to have the resiliency and wherewithal to bust their ass to make this work. I want to lean into, okay, so there's ways to spot narcissists too, right? Tell me about a time that you screwed up.
Sure.
What's the last big mistake you made, and how did you handle that? Because a narcissist, for those that don't know, can't accept blame. Not even 1%, where Roy and I can sit here and look at a situation and go, even though the person that sued me for discrimination a couple of years ago, like I can sit here and go, okay, this percentage of the problem was me. Narcissists can't accept 1% blame. So there's a big red flag there. So if you get into a conversation like, where did you screw up? How did you screw up? If they're assigning blame and playing the victim kind of, then you know that there's probably a humility at the very least, if not a clinical narcissist diagnosis there. There's another way where you can ask them about their previous bosses. How do they speak about their previous leadership, right? Did they accept ownership, or did they say, you know, this person's an asshole, that company sucks, the culture sucks, all this different stuff? That's probably how they're going to talk about your culture when they leave your organization. So the questions that you ask should be far more interpersonal and get them to tell you stories about what they've overcome, what they've happened in their life, talk about childhood stuff, right? So that middle interview, we called our in-depth, that was far more informative to them of like taking the macro level world down to the micro level world and what it's going to be like, what they need to track, how hard it's going to be, stuff of that nature. My interview was far more, okay, you've gotten through those two. We've had multiple sets of eyes on you. We think you can make it here. Now I'm going to put the final stamp of approval on you if I'm going to let you into my culture or not, to make sure that you're not going to mess it up. And also to get to know me, the leader of the firm, and have that one-on-one time with, because at first, until they become a leader within my firm, they're probably not going to have a ton of time with me. So it's at least building that bridge to get to know them and ask some deep questions. So, you know, hey, I can ask about, hey, I found out in the interview process that his wife was 6 months along. And then I can check in, 3 months later, how are things going? You ready for that baby yet? Whatever it might be. We're getting to know each other at a deeper level. I already know they're a good fit for the most part, say 90% of the way there. The last 10%, I'm closing that gap and making sure that they have other questions. One other great tidbit I'll give people, depending on how you take this process, is we had them sometimes do a reverse in-depth, where after we gave them all the micro, we'd send them home to digest everything, and a week later come back, and they interviewed us. So we had them go write all the questions that you possibly want and or possibly could think of. Any question, nothing's off limits. And you're going to interview us in that. And also in that third interview for the full-time side of things, I know you and I talked about the intern side of things, but when we were having someone come in and they're going to start their own business as a financial advisor, they're starting at a $0 offer. Now, we have some incentives in place to get them off to a fast start, but essentially you're leaving a career that paid you some money for a career that had a whole lot more upside, but you're starting at zero. So I wanted their spouse involved in that final meeting so that they knew what they were up for. And I also want to know how supportive that spouse was going to be, because in sales, financial advising, or any type of sales or commission world like that, you get beat up during the day. You can get hung up on, you can get told no, you go through some mental challenges. The last thing that person needs, whether male or female, is their spouse at home going, see, I told you you shouldn't have done that, and beating up even further. So I needed to know that their spouse was on board, and that their spouse could ask questions and get to know me to make sure that they felt good about the situation, that they were comfortable, and they were ready to attack the job.
These are, so you mentioned first, second, third interview. That first layer of interview, is it more traditional, or are you asking these questions as well?
I'd say Preston did a great job of asking some of those questions as well. Yeah, there might be some repeat questions there because he was really trying to get to know them as well as sell our culture.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because that's, those are the questions that are, you know, when you talk about preparing for an interview, right? I mean, it's been a long time since I interviewed, but I remember preparing for an interview, and I remember my parents saying, hey, are you prepared for the interview? And so it's like those questions are like, can you speak to your resume? Can you tell a story about your experience? Can you talk about the clubs that you're in, or the places that you volunteer, or your, you know, your leadership qualities, or your intangible? That you don't prepare for the questions that are off the cusp, that are like, tell me your favorite quote. Tell me something that inspired you that your parents did. And you're like,
tell me a joke.
Right.
I'd love to tell me a joke. By the way, the tell me a joke thing is a great question, especially if you need someone that can think on their feet.
Yeah.
A salesperson needs to be able to think on their feet. Tell me a joke. So me personally, when this was posed to me the first time, and this is why I remember it, because it was posed to me, I don't remember jokes well. And so I answered honestly. I was like, I think I remember a couple dirty jokes, which probably wouldn't be appropriate, but I don't remember jokes well. And that was my response. And so I got feedback later from the person that asked me that. They said, hey, just so you know, because I asked, I was like, hey, did I pass that joke test thing? Because I didn't really have a joke. And they're like, you did, because you answered immediately saying, hey, I don't really remember jokes that well. I'm not a joke teller. And so versus someone that freezes and is like trying to think through their repertoire of jokes and is this appropriate, is this not? And then there's this huge, long, awkward silence. Boom. Or if they just blurt out an inappropriate joke, now reading the room, that's another tell. Is this person going to have the candor to be able to be in front of our top client?
Interesting. Yeah. See, I would have thought that if you don't tell a joke, then you're like, not for, but there's deeper level to that, to say, well, you gave a response and you gave an acceptable response without telling the brown probe joke, you know, talking about how you're a doctor who drives a brown probe, right?
So,
yeah. Cause that honestly, that's where my head went straight to. I'm like, oh, well, you know, an inappropriate joke.
Because usually those are the jokes we tell each other, especially.
That's right. Those are the only jokes I got, you know? Oh, man. So do you use any, like, so we use something called Predictive Index. Do you use any type of, like, personality assessment, or is there anything like that that you guys use to?
That's a great question. By the way, Predictive Index came from the Culture Index, and the Culture Index is what we used very well. Like, I know that, like, the back of my hand. And, so they're very, very similar. And so there's assessments that you can use in recruiting. And I think that the culture and the predictive index are both very good at recruiting. Then there's, and I think that's for main roles. I also think the Colby can be useful in recruiting, but also just in staffing in general. And the Colby, again, is spelled K-O-L-B-E. And it's really helpful to, as you're trying to piece the puzzles together, where is our leadership team strong and where do we potentially have a weakness? Now we're going to go look to plug that weakness on the Colby index, right? So I think that's very good. But when you get into DISC, when you get into some of those Myers-Briggs, those are not recruiting tools. Those are personality profiles. So I've heard some people use those. And I'm like, how do you use those? They're not great recruiting. They're good at knowing the person once they're there, but not great at recruiting.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually a certified DISC instructor. And there is the, it's the four different personalities and how you can have multiple personalities or multiple hats within your personality that make up your personality. And we did that when I was at the, when I was a government employee, and it was a way to understand who was on our team. So much of the government, right, is a manager steps in. We had a new director come in, and the new director wanted to do the DISC assessment. And so that's how it got introduced. And it was the government, you have a director step in, and they don't get to choose their people. They inherit their people. And so you're like, okay, well, what do I got? Who's on the team here? You know, what's the report? You can sit down with each individual and they're going to give you the Sports Center top 10 plays and what they're good at and what they think that they do and what they actually bring and X, Y, and Z. The DISC assessment, I feel like, is really good for a manager who's stepping in that didn't get to choose their people. I don't think it's, to your point, I don't think it is good to say, who can I attract? Because a big part of DISC, as you know, is I could be a D in one, as a coach, and I could be an S or a C at church, and I could be an I at work. So if you took that DISC assessment, it could be based on your understanding and your persona and your personality in a totally different environment that doesn't match your company's culture. And that's a huge red flag an area of caution I'll throw to those who are using DISC as a recruiting tool, because predictive index is a little different than, to your point, is a little different. Do you guys use DISC internally?
No. We use the Colby internally Culture Index mainly for that. I will take, there's Strengths Finders, and then there's a new one that came from Gallup on Strengths Finders, Standout Report. And it really shows you your kind of top two traits, because your top five for Strengths Finders, that's where, you should spend 80 to 90% of your time. And then your number 6 through 10 should be the remainder of that time. And anything underneath that, stay away from it and hire people that would fit in those weaknesses. So, I'm high, and the same thing, like I'm high visionary, high collaborative. And I needed someone on the integrator side. I'm a 96 or 98%, if I recall correctly. I know it was an even number, high 90s, on the visionary side. So my integration, my detail level of detail is so bad that I needed a really strong integrator. So Alicia, my integrator, who I had at my firm and I recruited to come start with this thing with me, she's a 98% on integrator. So anyone that wants to take those, and if they want to, so when I talk about visionary integrator, that's your classic Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak analogy. And so Jobs obviously was a visionary, Woz got everything done. You can take the crystallizer assessment for free if you go to rocketfuel.com. And if you think you have someone on your team that might be an integrator, if you want to hire someone that's going to be an integrator, like I had Alicia before I hired her, take the crystallizer assessment to make sure. We thought she was right? So, but I wanted to make sure that was who we were getting part of that interview. Oh, here's another thing I did recently. So I just made an offer and got an accept on the director of marketing. And I didn't even take him through the traditional interview process because I know him. But I needed to make sure of his skill set because I've been outsourcing podcast reels and my social media reels and a couple other things. And I was like, I can't afford him and continue to outsource. So I sent him raw video to make sure that he could do what he do what we needed him to do. And so you guys can do stuff like that as well. It's like, if you think you know, send them some homework. Test it. Test your theory and test their abilities. Don't be afraid to do it. Because if you already have the rapport, like he and I already had the rapport, he's like, yeah, I'd love to work for you. I was like, I'd love to have you work for me. I need to make sure you can do these things like I think you can. And he's like, no problem.
I love that. Well, hey, we're getting close to time, and I appreciate you coming on. I want to be make sure that I'm not taking up your whole morning. I know that that cigar is getting low, and I appreciate you spending it with me.
It's been great. Get to talk to my friend Roy and smoke a cigar, drink some coffee.
Amen, brother. I mean, this is I could nerd on. I could go all day. So don't let me do that to you, because I will. In terms of, there was one question I wanted to ask you about. There's a quote that I heard recently. Well, I read it in a book, Atomic Habits. And I read a book and I listen to the audio at the same time. And so I was listening to the Audible in my truck, and I had read the quote and it hit me. But when I heard it, it really hit me. And that was, we don't rise to our goals, but we fall to our systems. And it was like, oh my gosh, like how, of course, you know, we can project what we want to accomplish, and that's important, but we're only going to get accomplished what we have in place as to what we do and who we say we are. And I know in EOS, there's both. And that's why I love that is there is are they called rocks? Is that what they're called in EOS?
Yes. Yeah. 90-day rocks.
Explain rocks to me. Those are the 90-day milestones, essentially, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's Stephen Covey actually coined that term. And then there was this professor, this viral video you can look up on YouTube. If you just Google a professor and rocks or something of that nature, he puts a jar on his desk and fills it with golf balls, and that's the proverbial rocks. And then he says to the class, is the jar full? And they say, yes. And then he throws some gravel in there, and he says, now is the jar full? And they say, yes. And then he throws some sand in there. Now is the jar full? Yes. And then finally water. Well, if you do that in reverse, the golf balls don't fit in at all. So what the point is that your rocks are your most important things. They have to get done. They align you towards your lighthouse, right? The lighthouses get you towards your annual goals. Those are the most important things for the company. And then you break the company rocks down into individual rocks. So every single person on the team has at least one rock that's contributing to the overall company goals. And what's awesome about that is everyone feels bought in towards the mission and the goals that you're going at. So that's rocks. And then gravel are all the little day-to-day stuff. The sand is your daily interruptions, and water is everything else, right? And everyone knows what I'm talking about as we're talking through that, because everyone has daily interruptions, everyone has little to-dos, and everyone has everything else that really doesn't matter, but sometimes we make it matter. So rocks are crucially important. The other piece of it is it's neuroscience. The neuroscience says that our minds are built as not as marathoners, but as sprinters. So there's another great book called The 12-Week Year by Brian Moran, and he goes into the neuroscience of this. And so for what he sets up is the 12 weeks, right? If you take 12 times 4, that's 48. We live in a 52-week world, right? Well, the point he's saying is you sprint for 12 weeks, hit your major goals, hit your rocks, and then you take a week of vacation to rest, recuperate, and get rejuvenated to go after your next 12-week year. So in that essence, a quarter is now a year, a month is a quarter, and a week is a month. It really shortens your mindset and your time frames so that you sprint hard towards those big goals.
So the idea of the milestones and the sprints is one, when I started looking to EOS, that I immediately connected with from my technical background. So in IT, in the agile methodology is what it's referred to as, You have epics, right? And the epics is this epic quest that the character is to go on, similar to like, I always equate it back to like Mario or Lynx from Zelda, where they have to go save the princess, right? That's the epic quest. And then you have the themes, which are chunks that make up the epic quest, right? This is the underwater world of Mario, or the, you know, you got to go under the clouds or whatever it is, right? You got to go fight the, I don't know what Zelda does, or was Link stuff. I don't play that game, but I'm sure they're fighting some sort of monster or something, right? Those are the themes that make it up. And then you have the sprints, and the sprints are your smaller chunk milestones. Say, these are what I'm going to do, and we run in 2 week sprints. So it's like, over the next 2 weeks, I'm going to get these things done. And you measure it, and you say, did we do it? Yeah, high five. No, we didn't do it. Oh, well, what went wrong? Oh, what can we try differently? What can we do better? And then you do it again. You run again. And it's, and when I started to read that in the EOS, I fell in love with it, because to me, as a developer, it always made sense. That's how you release software. When you think of, you know, iPhones or whatever, they're on iPhone, you know, 1,000,006 or whatever they're on now with the, you know, the iOS update they got to do in the middle of the night. Yeah. That's all iteration, right? That's all releases. And if you can do that with your systems and processes in your business and yourself, I've always enjoyed that part of EOS. And the rocks really was something that when I do the one pager, you know, that has your rocks and, you know, where you're going to be at in a year and 3 years. And I think 10 years is the other one, right?
Yeah, in 10 years, yes. So you're right. But 10 years doesn't have to be 10 years. It's 5 to 30 years. It's as far as you can think out. But it's, you know, so if 30 years is what you can think out, you're a younger person, you want to do that, great. If you're on the back half of your business ownership career, let's say you're 60 years old, you only got 5 years, then it's 5 years. I have a lot of business owners going racing towards 2030 right now, so it's kind of a seven-year goal, because being at the end of a decade seems to make sense for them. But what you said there is on that agile piece is really cool. I have a great neuroscientist friend that's taught me a lot about this, and he's also big in the IT space, so he knows the agile world well. But he's talking through it as we have to become scientists of ourselves. And he was talking about this. I've had him on my podcast a couple of times through the lens of getting our kids to be scientists of themselves. It's one thing for us to be proud of them. It's even greater if they can be proud of themselves. So those 2 week sprints that you just talked about, if you can, okay, what went right? What went wrong? What could we have done better? That's like that action after action review that the military does. Or it's, I call them breakthrough projects. If you're plateauing in business, can we set a 2 week breakthrough project? Can we have a carrot or a stick at the end of it? I was given this example yesterday to one of my masterminds. I did this breakthrough project. I was coaching an advisor that was, this was about 10 years ago or something, because it was during the Hillary Clinton's campaign. He hated Hillary Clinton. And so he was more of a stick person than a carrot person. So what we came up with, he had to get a certain amount of referrals in 2 weeks. And he physically wrote out a check to the Hillary Rodham Clinton, it wasn't even the foundation, it was her campaign, for $2,500. And he sealed the envelope, addressed the envelope, stamped the envelope. And I had that envelope with the check in my desk. And if he didn't hit that goal in 2 weeks, I'm mailing that thing. You can guess that he hit his goal. So you might be a carrot or a stick person, but bottom line, sometimes you have to create these artificial either breakthrough projects or staying agile or rocks or whatever you want to call them to sprint for something, to break through that plateau and get yourself on your way to the next milestone.
That's so good. Oh, man. Because it is, it's a driving force, right? It's like, what can I get you to do that's going to motivate you to add a little extra effort here so you don't end up, you know, it's 48 hours pre-deadline and you're procrastinated, and then now you're trying to throw it all together. That's so hard. So where can people find you, Josh? How can people get in touch and learn more?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm pretty easy. So joshkosnick.com for all the main stuff, or at Josh Kosnick on all social media things. If you guys want to check out the farm, we finally got a website up and running. It's Five Bridges. And that's in spell out Five Bridges, fivebridgesfarm.com. Would love to host you, your family, your teams, weddings, whatever we want to do up here. It's a beautiful property. You can check it out. And so we'd love to impact you. If you have any questions, DM me. I'm very responsive. at Josh Kosnick on Instagram, LinkedIn, wherever your favorite platform is. I'm not really on TikTok, Snapchat, or I guess I am on Twitter or X, but really it's Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. I'm on my main ones right now.
Wonderful, man. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. Very much appreciated, buddy. Josh and I are in a book club. Well, it's your book club. I love that, man. I love getting the book every month. We just read Unreasonable Hospitality, which I can't wait to nerd out with you on. That's like one of my favorites.
I know. That was so good. I actually put that in my financial advisor mastermind. And I was like, hey, everyone needs to read this.
It's so
good. Like it gets you to think. I actually, if you compare, I don't know if you've read Giftology by John Rulin, but if you pair those two books together, like back to back, I think, you know, for what did they call it in Unreasonable Hospitality? Those
Dreamweaver,
those special gifts. Yeah, the Dreamweaver thing. If you think about Giftology as they think about the Dreamweavers and the special gifts they were doing for people. Uh-huh. If you pair those two things together, those two books, I think you can come up with some amazing ideas on how to think differently, on how to treat your customers in a really, really special way and unique way.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look into Giftology. I just got Danny Meyer's book, Setting the Table. I haven't read it yet, but I just bought like 12 copies of it, and I'm sending it to my team. But Giftology will be the next one that I read. I appreciate you, Josh. Thank you so much, buddy. It's been an amazing time with you. I can't wait to break down Unreasonable Hospitality with you. And we'll have to have you come on again, man. It's been a blast.
Yeah, open for an anytime. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. Well, guys, thanks for hanging out. Go check out Josh. Thanks for listening to the podcast. You can find us on all major platforms, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube is where we're at as well with the video feed. So, guys, hope you got a lot out of this. Share the show. That's how we grow. And that rhymes. So see you next time.
Hey there. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button and turn on notifications for all the latest videos from Capital Presence.